You're listening to a podcast produced by the Jackson School of International Studies, the Center for West European Studies, and the European Union Center at the University of Washington. This and other podcasts can be found on iTunes and SoundCloud. For more information, visit us at jsis.washington.edu/EU West Europe.
Thank you so much, Sabina, and thank you to the Center for Western European Studies. I also want to thank my co-panelists today, Alexander and Frank, who were also co-authors of a couple of the books that we produced that came out in November and December. So thank you both for being here as well. I'm going to share some of the research that I was able to do while at the Army War College. The last couple of years specifically focused on hybrid warfare and energy security. So some of this research is coming out of that time in Europe on the ground. And then continuing now, we've just been approved for a second three-year project with the NATO Science and Technology Organization. So I'm continuing my research there supported by our task force students. So very happy about that. And so just presenting some of the basic concepts and takeaways that we had from this research. So let's start with what is hybrid warfare? So the definitions I'm going to be using throughout my talk are coming from NATO, basically the NATO handbook. And so when we look at hybrid warfare, we're talking about hybrid threats that combine military and non-military, as well as covert and overt means. So we look really at these three different categories: disinformation, cyber attacks, and economic pressure. So we're looking at, in that context, malign influence that can include diplomatic measures, that can include economic measures. And then we look at this other aspect that we've seen very much present in the Ukraine conflict, which is the use of irregular forces right next to traditional forces. So we've seen the Wagner Group come in being on the front lines. Now, this is not something new in this conflict. We saw over the last decade and since the first invasion that separatist militias have been present in Ukraine as part of this longer hybrid warfare effort. So that exchange of information, but also of methodologies between the regular armed forces and the irregular armed forces being a pattern that we are and have seen in Ukraine over years. So how is hybrid warfare making an impact in Europe, and what does that actually have to do with energy security? We have seen as part of this global destabilization campaign that it has affected energy security, causing a global energy crisis, but more specifically, really coming to bear in Europe. So we've seen from the beginning, from before the invasion, with the challenges and the disagreements we saw around Nord Stream, that prefacing the conflicts, we've seen a lot of challenges in terms of availability of energy because of that dependence on Russian supply. This has led to a number of challenges across the board. It's led to food shortages as the ports have been blocked for getting the grain out to countries that have desperately needed it. It's led to supply chain challenges around the world. And most importantly, a real challenge in terms of undermining a state's legitimacy, namely Ukraine. So what are some other patterns we've seen? We've seen kinetic attacks, that is physical attacks in tandem with cyber attacks. So usually within a 24 to 48 hour time period. What we've seen even in the last 2 to 4 weeks is really an increase in number of cyber attacks. So early in the war, a real focus on kinetic and now increasing use of new cyber means. We've also seen for the first time hypersonic warfare used on the battlefield. Until now, that was, a lot of the hypersonic weapons that were being developed were in the testing phase. They had never been used actually in the battlefield. And in this case, actually, we've had civilian casualties as a result and civilian targets hit. And then as we look at a percentage impact, we've seen a lot of impact happening from the disinformation campaigns that have come about. And I think Frank will talk a little bit more about what's gone on in Poland with those, but a lot of times the disinformation campaigns impacting, for example, government websites, and this then causing specifically energy to be impacted as a result. All right, so when we talk about energy security, what are we talking about? We're talking about the uninterrupted availability of energy sources at an affordable price. So the day of the invasion, prices skyrocketing. Again, as there's been challenges with availability, that affecting prices across Europe. Specifically, energy security has been targeted in the specific conflict. So let's even just talk about the last few months. Starting in October, almost a third of Ukraine's power stations and other energy generating facilities were destroyed in a wave of airstrikes. That has continued. So strikes on different kinds of energy critical infrastructure from the grid, many parts of the grid being destroyed, nuclear plants. We're aware of the kinetic attacks there. And then some cyber attacks mirroring some of those kinetic attacks as well. Oh, and this is a picture, by the way, this was made available by the Ukrainian Presidential Press Service, but this was a picture of one of the attacks there on one of their plants. All right, so let's talk a little bit more about the impact of hybrid warfare specifically on several of the NATO countries in Europe. One of the things that we noticed as we were, so I had the privilege during my time at the Army War College of actually being able to go in and observe some of the energy critical infrastructure and how it was being protected or not being protected. And one of the challenges that we faced was that a lot of the current energy critical infrastructure was connected versus via the Internet of Things. And so one of the challenges you have there, specifically in Western Europe, is you have a lot of smart grids. These are often layered over kind of your grandfather's grid which worked for a long period of time, but a lot of them are aging. And then being connected via cyber, one of the challenges was there wasn't comprehensive cybersecurity to protect some of those sources of entry. And so a little bit more easily hackable. As we look at renewables, this being another challenge, Europe, due to the Green Deal, trying to invest in a lot of renewables, but we're seeing things like the entry points where wind farms are connected, then that energy connecting back to the grid, we're seeing challenges with the cybersecurity protecting that as well. And then that interface between the IT world and the operational technology world also creating additional vulnerabilities. And so anywhere you're having sensors and that communication system back to the main control, to the industrial control systems, it's creating additional vulnerabilities when those are not encrypted, when there are additional entry points via the cybersphere. And so these were fully taken advantage of by Russia. So what we saw again and again was, Russia repeatedly testing and attacking Ukraine and NATO partners. It was very well broadcast in open source press, the attacks on the satellites and the initial, perhaps not intentional, results beyond Ukraine in terms of, for example, the wind farms in Germany being taken down, three different sets of wind farms, but also other energy critical infrastructure being targeted, such as gas pumps, such as pipelines, such as coal and thermal plants as targets. And don't forget that Moscow had already done a number of test runs in the years leading up to this. So they'd already gone into the US grid, they'd already gone into the German grid, and they had taken down the Ukraine grid several years before. And so they had gained intelligence during that period of time that they would be able to act on if they came into a conflict such as this. All right, so future destructive exploits being available in the future. And then as we look forward, there were several other challenges that we saw. So in terms of immediate impacts on NATO, increased cyber threats to energy critical infrastructure and insufficient cyber early warning systems. This is one of the things that we focused on the class that my other panelist here, Frank, was in. So we did a survey basically of what cyber early warning systems were available in each of those NATO priority countries and found that there weren't really safe norms. Whereas European Union had several years ago passed standardization that needed to be put in place. There's not the same standardization in NATO, and even the EU process that's in place, it hasn't completely worked. Some countries are lagging far behind others. So that has left these countries wide open. Most of the early warning systems we looked at, they were based on what's called anomaly detection, which is basically looking to the past at what attacks have already occurred, but not the attacks that are happening now, not the attacks as we go forward. So what we saw in the third quarter of 2022 really marked a turning point of cyber attacks related to the conflict in Ukraine. So there was a clear transition from a cyber war focused on Ukraine and Russia to a high intensity hybrid cyber war across Europe. So it was targeting specifically Poland and the Baltic countries and the Nordic countries in particular as they made their way towards NATO membership. Let's keep in mind, Finland just joined today. And then with an increasing focus on critical national infrastructure in sections like aviation, like energy, like healthcare, banking, and public services. Some of the attacks were not that creative, but the hacktivists started using denial of service attacks to make servers temporarily inaccessible and disrupt some of those public services. And so Eastern and Northern Europe really being on the front lines of that cyber conflict. And so basically over the last year, and a lot of this information, also public reporting by Thales, a new attack geography really taking place in the last 12 months. So whereas the beginning of the war, we saw primarily focus on Ukraine with 50% in the first quarter of 2022 from those cyber attacks. In the last quarter, we've really seen EU countries have a sharp increase. So 46.5% of global attacks were focused on European countries, and those specifically I mentioned before that have been supporting Ukraine. All right. Now, when we're looking at the breakdown of who's actually launching those attacks, they were able to trace back over 60% to 61% perpetrated by pro-Russian hacktivist groups that, you know, kind of leave more familiar footprints. So those are groups like Anonymous Russia, like Killnet, like Russian hacker teams. So we're seeing basically at this point, many conflict-related incidents in the European Union countries, basically almost paralleling the number pointed at Ukraine. So 85 pointed at these European countries that were supporting Ukraine, and 86 at Ukraine themselves. So an overwhelming majority of the incidents being inside the European Union. Why do I mention cyber in this context? Because it is affecting the energy critical infrastructure and the chief energy supply chain. And so that impacts in turn NATO's military effectiveness. We have these military bases across Europe And if they're dependent on grids that have been compromised, if they're dependent on energy critical infrastructure that has had espionage, malicious intrusions, then the military cannot necessarily do its job and get from point A to point B if they have those challenges. All right. So I want to just talk briefly here about just some of the research that I've done on green energy and why Europe isn't using more. So remember back to a few years ago when all of Europe and the EU basically declared the Green Energy Deal. First year that that was put in place ended up being during the pandemic. So they met all of their goals and they actually did better than even predicted. No one was driving to work, everyone was at home. We really did a great job of cutting down on emissions. Everyone was very excited that we were gonna meet our goals before we even had planned to. And then we had the challenge of everybody going back to work, but also this lack of energy supply. So what happened by August of last year was the majority of the energy supply was cut, both to countries like Germany and Poland, but many of the other European countries as well. And so they had to think about what are alternatives? Where are we gonna get this energy source from? Good news being that the European Union receives 37% of its electricity specifically from renewable sources, and that's largely wind, hydropower, and solar power, and 22% of their overall energy consumption actually comes from renewables. But the challenge with renewable technology being it can't double overnight. So in some cases, you know, as we're looking at energy supplying households, households can't go over and change up, you know, the oil or gas tanks they have in their homes. That takes time. It takes time to educate. It also takes space, right? So as we think about wind farms, solar farms, hydropower, you need a lot of land for that. And so these sources not being something that can immediately be put in place without the workforce and without the space to do so. That doesn't mean we shouldn't keep pressing ahead on that. It's just a matter of time. So one of the areas that the European Union has been looking at is the licensing challenges. Because any of these areas, like let's say solar, you have the same amount of paperwork that you have to do for a nuclear plant if you want to have, you know, a bit of solar. And you're right, it's not like, you know, my relatives in Yakima that have, you know, big kind of like a solar farm in their backyard. You can't just do that in Europe. You have to fill out a lot of paperwork. So the EU's been working on that. It's not worked out so much. It has worked for the liquid natural gas terminals. They've cut the paperwork on that, but not on the renewables yet. So that hasn't come through in the way that we have been hoping for. As I mentioned before, on renewables, the cybersecurity challenge as well. Because the cybersecurity isn't as mature as it should be, and the storage for that energy hasn't been as mature as it should be. So let's talk briefly about where we are with renewable energy. That specifically being defined as usable energy derived from replenishable sources. So we are thinking about solar, about wind, about hydroelectric power and geothermal. Biomass as well. So you see the northern countries that have lots of sunlight and that have lots of wind doing really well on that. Some of the other Western European countries way down at the bottom are still struggling. Sorry.
Why is nuclear?
I'm going to talk about nuclear in just a second. Yep, I haven't forgotten about nuclear. So that's actually my next slide. Here we go. There you've got it right there on the left-hand side. One of the, as we look at energy policies, one of the challenges has been an initial massive increase in costs. So we did see that those costs shoot up 62% on the day of the invasion. Now, Europe has tried to put a cap on some of these prices for industries that is not trickled down to households, right? So costs remain high for households. Industry has, even utility companies have gone ahead and pre-charged us for what they think that the high heating costs, the high electricity costs will be in the household. We've gotten our bills, which have been double and triple. I have a household in Germany, and so they are going ahead and they're pre-charging us, anticipating costs to be very high, and they're getting taking advantage of those government caps. And it's pretty much that way across several European countries. But that government price cap coming into bear. Again, as I mentioned, despite the climate goals, what has happened is they turned around and filled the gap with coal instead of nuclear. So in the case of Germany, where I did a lot of my research, they actually decided to cut down on nuclear, to go ahead with their plans on cutting down on nuclear. They kept a couple down in Bavaria alive through this month. My guess is they're gonna be extending that, but nuclear being, not having emissions, coal having plenty of emissions, but there's been an emotional reaction on the German front as well as a political reaction against nuclear. So I agree with you, Chris. I would agree this would be actually one of the solutions in terms of long-term energy. In France, they've used it as a solution. They've actually cut down on emissions and they've cut their prices as well. Now, just because most of the gas flowing from Russia has been cut doesn't mean it's completely been cut. It's been cut 88%, but you still have the gas that's flowing is flowing through Ukraine and it is flowing through Turkey. So we do still have that. However, they are looking at supplying gas from other countries as well. All right, let's talk about solutions. And I wanna make sure that I give everybody else enough time, but these are just a few of the solutions we looked at. One, being nuclear. So nuclear being a low emission source, what countries like Germany have done is they're actually not decreasing their amount of usage of nuclear. They're just buying it from other countries like France. And so just putting the one real environmental challenge being the waste, they're pushing that across the boundary line there of the country. The other solution being bioenergy. Now, I really do think this is a solution for the future because this is waste, right? You have a bad crop season. You can actually use those bad crops and turn it into bioenergy. You can use household waste. You can use old wood. So that's am I over time?
You could.
Okay. You can use all of those sources to actually create energy. One of the other things that we looked at was microgridding, and we looked at that specifically, not just because we were excited about solar, but also because we're looking at one of the challenges to if a central grid goes down and is experiencing cyber attacks, if you could actually have your own grid supplying, for example, a military base or a neighborhood. Now, what we found with that as we looked at different case studies across Europe was that sometimes cybersecurity was not built into the front end. So that being a necessary, if you're gonna build a separate grid, you need to have that cybersecurity built in, or you're gonna have a problem, the same problem that you've had on the main grid. And then finally, ensuring that cyber early warning, those cyber early warning standards are improved and normed across Europe. So those are the main solutions that we looked at. In closing, I wanna just talk about the fact that as we look towards Europe's future with energy security, whether Europe finds sustainable solutions will really depend on three things. It will depend on making trustworthy partnerships, first of all. Secondly, it will depend on investing in new technology and technology protection for the long term. And third, being willing to make some sacrifices to decrease the use of fossil fuels and increase the use of sources like bioenergy and nuclear. It won't be popular, it won't be easy, but Europe probably has little choice at this point. So with that, I want to say I'm so grateful to Sabina, and I'm so grateful to my co-authors. And with that, I want to turn it over to Alexandra.